What do you call a can opener that doesn't work? A can't opener. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Starting Sustainability. This is episode 149, and I am your host, Kaylin Chenoweth. We are back from vacation. We ended up going to Du Bois, Pennsylvania, which that's how it's pronounced because a local corrected me. It's D-U space B-O-I-S, and I said Du Bois because I took French all in high school, and that's how you would pronounce it. But our server at Pizza Hut corrected me and said, here we call it Du Bois. Oh, okay. It's Du Bois, Pennsylvania. That's where we went. Before you can go away on vacation, especially if you have a spouse and three children, there is a lot of prep work that you have to do. A lot of packing and planning and coordinating. Not to mention, I had a lot of garden produce, which is great. I had cucumbers. So many cucumbers. I pickled them all before we left. Why? Because I dislike pickles. But I'm not really sure what else you can do with cucumbers, and Channing likes pickles. Therefore, I made pickles for him. And my house reeked of vinegar for 2 days straight. That's love. I also had 6 yellow squash to use up, and I wasn't really sure what to do with them. And then I found some yellow squash soup recipes, and I thought, ding, 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 that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make some yellow squash soups. One of them was a yellow squash and corn chowder, and the other one was a Thai, like Thailand, Thai-style yellow squash soup. Both of them smelled amazing to make and looked delicious, and when I tasted them, they were super bland. And I was a little disheartened because it was a lot of work for them to not be that good. I did my best to doctor them up. I added a lot of seasonings to help give them some flavor, but I'm not really going to hold my breath. I'm probably going to be the only one eating them. I saved them and I poured them into the silicone storage Ziploc bags. That way I could freeze them. And then when it was time to eat the soup, I could just grab it, because you can put that silicone storage bag straight into hot boiling water to help thaw out the soup, which really I would just dump it out and put it in a crock pot, turn it on and let it cook all day long and smell delicious and make the house smell great. At least I did those last. I did the pickles first and then I did the yellow squash last, and that helped negate some of the vinegar smell. And while we're on the topic of preserving goodies from the garden, I did make some posts in the Facebook group how I have an abundance of herbs. They have grown very big since I first got them back in May and planted them. They're cute little tiny plants, and now they're like bushes of herbs and so many herbs. I clipped them and bound them up with a rubber band and hung them up and waited for a week to go by, because honestly, drying them in the dehydrator still takes like a good 2 solid days. It's insane how long it takes. And I thought, well, instead of running the electricity and doing the dehydrator, taking up my precious counter space because we cook all of our meals, I thought I'll just tie these up and hang them. And I did that for a whole week and they dried up very nicely. I just crushed them all up and put them inside of a shaker, a seasoning shaker. I guess that's what they're called. Just drew a blank. But you know what I mean? It's the thing that you put herbs in and to shake them onto your food. Oh my gosh, my brain is not working today. I did bust out the dehydrator because I had oodles and oodles of little cherry tomatoes, which are delicious, and I'm eating them like candy. They're very tasty. I have some cool varieties. I have a purple Cherokee, which are little tiny purple tomatoes, and then there's sun sugar, which is orange yellow tomatoes, super sweet. Those are my new favorite tomatoes. I recommend those. And then the traditional little red cherry tomatoes. I don't know. I have about 6 different varieties of those. Anyways, the garden is pumping out tomatoes finally. Literally took all summer long. Now that it is September, my garden is finally pumping out tomatoes and I can't eat them fast enough. And I saw on a Facebook group about food preservation, canning, and drying, somebody said to dry them in the dehydrator because they make the best snacks, like little sun-dried tomato chips. And I thought, oh, cool. Yeah, I'll give that a try. Cut them all in half, put them in dehydrator. That took about 12 to 16 hours for some of the thicker ones. And I was so excited to try them because they came out like little beautiful little tomato chips. Grabbed one, ate it, thought, wow, that's bitter. Grabbed a couple more, ate those. Yeah, still bitter. Definitely better as a fresh tomato. I don't agree with the person who posted and published that post, bragging about their dehydrated tomatoes as snacks. I think they would be excellent in a stew, on top of a salad, but definitely not as a snack, plain as is snack. How was our vacation? Going back to the original start of this conversation. Well, it was 90 degrees all week long, which is hot. That is really hot. And as I mentioned, we were in Dubois, Pennsylvania. There happened to be an escaped convict at the exact same time we were on vacation. Now, the prison he escaped from was 4 hours away, but nobody knew where he was going, and they couldn't find him. And I think it ended up taking 10 days to find this guy. So we didn't really feel like going hiking. That was why we went to that town, because it was near mountains and we wanted to go hiking. Plus, it was 90 degrees. So between the convict and 90 degrees, we decided we weren't going to go hiking. And that's okay. There was an outdoor pool at the place that we were at. We thought, great, perfect. Well, we were gone over Labor Day week, and the outdoor pool closed on Labor Day. So it was open on Monday and then closed the whole rest of the week. And it continued to be 90 degrees. So that kind of stunk. Good news is there was a lake nearby with a beach. We thought, oh, perfect, we'll go there and play. They had a nice little playground right there by the water, the sand the kids could play, and then hop into the lake to cool off. The beach was closed because of a high bacterial count. We thought, Channing and I would risk it, but since we have three very little kids, we're not going to risk that. That is not a fun way to spend your vacation in a hospital. So we opted to not do that. So this vacation, we were kind of struggling to find some fun things to do, but we did meet a celebrity, and we were very excited about that. We made a special 45-minute drive to the town of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and we got to meet Punxsutawney Phil. Do you know who that is? That is the groundhog who makes his debut every year on Groundhog's Day and looks to see if he has a shadow or not. He is the weather predictor, and he lives at the Punxsutawney Town Library, and you can go visit him and his little burrow. It's a nice glass enclosure, kind of like what you would see at a zoo. It's about a good 5 by 6 foot area. It's actually Phil and Phyllis, because Phil will leave and go on tour, and they want to make sure there is always a groundhog there. So sometimes it'll just be Phyllis, which I thought was hilarious. When we were on vacation, we did utilize disposable diapers. It's really hard to do cloth diapers if you don't have this setup, and going out on vacation makes it tough because you're running around and you're traveling and you got to carry it. You have to transport the clean and dirty cloth diapers, and you don't always have a laundry facility to wash them. You don't have a sprayer on the back of your toilet to get the poo out of the diapers. So for 1 week, we do disposables, and that's okay. We definitely missed cloth diapers very, very much. We could not wait to get back and do cloth diapers. Little Hazley had a poop explosion probably 2 to 3 times a day. We actually had to stop in the middle of the week and go do laundry because I ran out of outfits for her. We were absolutely elated to get back to the house and get back into cloth diapers because we were really tired of cleaning up poopy messes. I really, really dislike disposable diapers, not just for the sustainability aspect and the fact that when disposable diapers go to the landfill, they sit there for 500 years, but because they are so messy, and we really rely on cloth diapers because they're elastic. Cloth diapers are elastic all the way around, so it's a nice tight fit around your kids so they can poop all they want, and it is not shooting up their back, and it is not shooting down their legs, and life is amazing. You know what else we couldn't wait to get back to? Actually, this straight out of Channing's mouth. I cannot wait to get back to the house and use the bidet sprayer. The Butt Blaster 3000, as he likes to call it. Well, okay, really, his version uses a cuss word, and I just changed it to butt. But anyways, on vacation, his only option was toilet paper, crummy toilet paper at that, and he absolutely hated using that. I find this whole thing quite amusing because when I asked for a bidet sprayer years ago, he gave me such a hard time about it, and it took him over a year to install it, and he finally, actually, I think it was almost a year and a half. Either way, he finally installed it, and then I couldn't get him to use it for the longest time, and then he finally used it, and now he's in love with it. So if you have a spouse who is resistant to sustainability measures like mine, do know that they will come around eventually. Currently, this week, Channing is off to Iowa for a week of training for his job. That means I am single momming it all week long. Well, with the help of my really awesome sister, Michelle, who is currently watching the kids while I am traveling for work, because I work Wednesdays and Thursdays out of town. I work from home the other days of the week, but while I'm out of town, recording this podcast at the Airbnb that I'm staying at, because it's the only time I can get peace and quiet and not get interrupted 100 times. So thank you, Michelle. You are amazing. You're fantastic. You're awesome. And I really appreciate you. So she's watching the kids right now. And the last thing that I wanted to share about having kids, there are hundreds and thousands of reasons on how kids stress out their parents. And here's my most recent experience. On Tuesday, it was school picture day. So guess who decided to cut their own hair on Sunday night? Oh yeah. Both boys got a hold of a pair of scissors. The kid scissors, the little scissors, the safety scissors. And Corbin cut his own hair. And then he cut his little brother's hair. And they were playing, and they were laughing and giggling while Channing and I were cleaning up dinner. And then they got really quiet and kept giggling. So I decided to go check on them, and I opened up the bedroom door and saw what was happening. It's so quick. I did my best to fix it, but he is going to have some pretty awesome kindergarten school photos this year. I want to do a news update. Well, this update is about a month behind. I kind of forgot to put it on the last episode, so I'm putting it on here now. I still think it's fascinating and I want to share it. If you're like me, super busy and not really paying attention to the news at all, you'll also find this interesting. So maybe this is news to you too. It is no longer called global warming. It is now called global boiling. The month of July went down on record as the hottest month ever for human civilization. That is ridiculous, astronomical, insanely crazy. And that is according to European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service, who proclaimed July beyond record smashing. This is not a joke. The actual real title is now global boiling. It was so hot in Arizona, it was an average of 110 multiple days in the 120s. Doctors saw a spike of patients who were burnt just by falling onto the ground. Burn centers were maxed out, and about 1/3 of the patients were people who fell on the ground, because asphalt can get up to 40 to 60 degrees hotter than the air temperature. An Arizona elementary school librarian even claimed that his shoes melted as he was just doing his crosswalk duties. He was helping the kids cross the street after school, and he was there for about 30 minutes, and the soles of his shoes melted by standing on the asphalt. That's mind-blowing. Leaving Arizona and heading over to a place called the Green Swamps, all the way on the southeasternmost corner of North Carolina. That is where today's main topic is taking place. The Green Swamps is 17,000 acres of savanna and swampland. It's known mostly for its bird watching and longleaf pines, but it's also a highly sought after area for quite an unusual black market for an incredibly rare plant, the Venus flytrap. The black market has exploded in the last few years and shows no signs of slowing down, resulting in the Venus flytrap disappearing by the thousands. The sources for today's episode come from a Mental Floss article titled Venus Flytraps in Peril and a Bloomberg Law article as well. And there is heavy reliance on an episode from the podcast Criminal, which is where I first heard about this and thought, what? This is real? This is a thing? There's a black market for Venus flytraps? So I listened to the whole episode and thought, oh yeah, I definitely have to share this with all of the Starting Sustainability listeners. And then I did some additional research to give a nice update on what's going on. Just to clarify, the Venus flytrap plant does not look anything like the one that you would have seen in Little Shop of Horrors. These are not huge people-eating plants. In fact, they are quite small, around 4 to 5 inches tall on the maximum. Most of them are definitely smaller than that. The plant is green and there is a head at the top, which kind of looks like a taco. It's a bright red inside, which makes them highly visible to insects. And inside the mouth part of this taco-shaped head are a bunch of little trigger hairs, kind of like whiskers. The Venus flytrap head is open, and it's in a constant state of tension, kind of like a mouse trap, until something comes along and touches the trigger, or the trigger hair, which would then snap it shut. What's really interesting is that the insect must touch 2 trigger hairs, and then the plant will snap shut. If it just touches one, it's kind of like putting the plant on alert, but once a second trigger hair is touched, then the plant knows, oh, this isn't like, you know, a fragment of a leaf that fell in here. Like, whatever is inside of my mouth area is moving and I want to eat it. And then it snaps shut and gulps down the insect. Really, yeah, it's called Venus flytrap, and flies definitely do get eaten, but it's really any insect that enters it is doomed. Every year, for the past few years, tens of thousands of flytraps have gone missing, not only from the wild, but also from gardens and plant nurseries. These actions are decimating the population of the Venus flytrap, and it's pretty crazy to think that there's even a Venus flytrap crime ring in rural North Carolina. But there is. There really is. There are lackeys, middlemen, and a mysterious end buyer who's fueling this black market. There was a plant nursery about 10 miles south of the green swamp called Flytrap Farm, and it's in North Carolina. Flytrap Farm, as you might have guessed, specializes in bulk sales of Venus flytraps. About 10 years ago, a group of people broke into the greenhouse by removing the glass, considerately laid the glass on cardboard so it wouldn't break. So these are criminals with a heart. And they basically ripped all the plants out of the pots and then stashed the plants inside of trash bags that they got from the greenhouse. They literally stole the trash bags at the greenhouse to put the stolen fly traps inside of and took off. According to the owners, the place looked like it had been hit by a hurricane. There are footprints in the soil, there are tire marks behind the greenhouses, and they stole about 18,000 plants in total. Most of them were Venus flytraps. It was estimated to be about $65,000 worth of plants. And at that point in time, it was the largest theft of flytraps ever. That means they weren't the only burglary for flytraps. Just a few months prior to that, someone dug up over $20,000 worth of flytraps from a park in Wilmington, North Carolina. There was a local person who had passed away, and they did a big memorial garden for her at the park, and those plants were stolen too. That is so disrespectful and is utter disgust. To be honest, I didn't even realize Venus flytraps grew in North Carolina. I kind of thought they grew in the Amazon and the tropics. Maybe Florida. I remember visiting a plant nursery when I lived in Florida and they had them, but I didn't know if they grew them there naturally or how they really got it. I didn't take the time to inquire. But apparently, Wilmington, North Carolina is known as Flytrap Central. Who knew? This is the only place in the world where Venus flytraps grow in the wild. It grows within a 90-mile radius of Wilmington, North Carolina. There is a park nearby called Flytrap Downs, and there is even a Flytrap 5K run every year. I really want to go visit Wilmington, North Carolina now, just to say that I have been there and seen all of the flytraps in their natural environment. It is likely flytraps were all over this part of North Carolina 100 years ago, but because of land development for golf courses and shopping centers in the area, plants and animal populations have dwindled. What's left can be found in a few protected preserves that have been around for years. However, in the last decade or so, something in the market shifted and the demand for flytraps has significantly increased, and this is causing all sorts of environmental problems. I mentioned flytrap plants were stolen from plant nurseries and even memorial gardens. Really, they are disappearing the quickest from the green swamp, which is home to the biggest concentration of these plants. There are officers with the Wildlife Resources Commission who do their best to protect the flytraps in the green swamp, but it's really quite a challenge. First of all, it's very dangerous. The tool of the trade is a machete. The poachers will get dropped off, so there is no car to give away their location, and then they go off the trail and are easily hidden by the surrounding foliage. People poach flytraps from the ground, because that's where they grow. That means they are down on their hands and knees below the grass line. Because if you've ever been to an area like that, there's lots of very bushy plants. So the moment that you get down on your hands and knees, all the plants around you have hidden you. Literally, an officer will have to drive by and see a couple of heads pop up in the swamp. And that's how they know they must be poachers. It kind of reminds me of the game Whack-A-Mole from the arcade, where they just pop up, pop up. And then they see a car drive by and pop back down. If the officer does see them, they would have to pull over, get out of their car, and chase them down on foot. And ideally, they would catch them and arrest them and confiscate the plants. The poachers will carry the fly traps in just about anything, including pillowcases and backpacks, which also makes it hard to tell, is this a poacher or just somebody out here hiking? I mentioned machete was the tool of the trade, but also garden spades, cut-off crowbars. They use a variety of tools that can also be used on the officers. Therefore, the officers need to be aware and cautious. It's kind of interesting to see how hard these poachers work at working illegally. I think things would be a lot easier if they got a legal job. It's also difficult to catch the poachers because they don't follow a traditional work schedule, meaning they work all around the clock every day of the week. Officers have put up a lot of cameras, like game trail cameras, which were stolen. And there was an interview where they even talked about how poachers would leave spoons behind an area to mark where they had already looked, and they know to go move forward in a different direction from that spot. So when officers see all of these spoons on the ground, they will confiscate all of them. I don't know why that's really funny to me, because it makes me think of the prank when people fork somebody and they put thousands of forks all in the yard. So it just makes me think of that, just spoons instead of forks. When the officers were interviewed, they shared some stories about the poachers, and they divulged that the poacher culture is just like it is with any other black market. The poachers will actually call and report other poachers, mostly to eliminate the competition. They get mad if someone is on their turf. In the last decade, things have gotten really bad. The fly trap has some federal and state protections, but there's just not enough information to actually call it threatened or endangered. Unfortunately, nobody actually knows how many fly traps there are, and nobody knows exactly how many are being poached. The only number any academic has come up with is 35,000 left in the wild, but it's really unclear how accurate that number is. We do know they only grow in a handful of places, and we do know they're disappearing by the thousands from the wild, and it's clear the poachers are selling them. Poachers who were caught reported getting paid between 10 to 25 cents per plant. 1,000 plants could be a couple hundred dollars. And get this, it's not illegal to sell the Venus flytraps, so anyone, including plant nurseries, could buy them. It is only illegal to dig them up from the wild. So yeah, some plant nurseries do have licenses to buy fly traps. And it gets really tricky because those who are considered poachers now used to be called farmers. And it turns out people have been digging these plants up for decades, but it was always under control. The state would give out licenses and anyone could ask to pull from someone else's property. Problem is, a fly trap from someone's backyard looks exactly the same as a fly trap from protected lands, and there's really no way to verify where it actually came from. However, nowadays, if a plant nursery gets caught buying poached plants, they will get shut down by the state. There are a handful of nurseries in North Carolina that deal mainly with carnivorous plants. What everybody seems to agree on is that these nurseries are not the end buyer. They are just the middleman. Somebody is buying in bulk at a rate unlike anything before, and most people have the same theory. There's a guy in New York, and he's created a supplement called Carnivora, basically carnivore with an A on the end, Carnivora, and he claims it will cure cancer. He's buying about 4 million plants a year and crushing them up and taking the juice from them, and he claims it's a cure for cancer. Carnivora was created in the 1970s by Helmut Keller, who was a German physician. This guy passed away about 14 years ago. And when you go to carnivora.com, you can purchase two products, liquid drops and capsules made from what it calls pure extract of Venus flytrap. The tagline on the website is Nature's Nutritional Powerhouse. The website is slightly cheesy. Yes, I did go and check it out. Because of FDA regulation, Carnivora cannot claim to actually cure any diseases. They can say this is a powerful immune defense supplement and that it wakes up specific immune cells to turn on your immune system to do the job that it's meant to do. In other countries, they can say anything they want. Therefore, the growth of Carnivora has grown exponentially, and the demand for fly traps has grown exponentially as a result. Per the CEO, Richard Ostro, Carnivora does not buy fly traps from North Carolina. Majority of their supplies is lab-grown fly trap tissue culture, kind of like the lab-grown meat, but a much simpler version. It's just replicating the fly trap cells to create the tissue. These labs are located in the Netherlands and China, and now there is a production facility here in the US. Carnivora as the end buyer is just a suspicion, because basically the poachers won't say who they are selling to, and the plant nurseries won't say where they are getting them from, and the alternative medicine market claims they are not purchasing the fly traps from North Carolina. So we still don't actually have any answers. How do we stop this madness? Well, for a very long time, if a poacher was caught harvesting fly traps from the wild, it was a $150 fine, which was basically less than one day's work. And they would only get caught maybe once a year. Poachers were making way too much money to be deterred by that fine. Finally, on December 1st, 2014, North Carolina upgraded Venus flytrap poaching from a misdemeanor to a Class H felony. Okay, I didn't even realize that class H was a thing. I'm pretty out of tune with the legal system and classifications, but that's where we're at. Class H felony. That means that poaching a single plant can now send someone to prison for months, and each plant that gets stolen is treated as an additional offense. On November 1st, 2015, so 11 months later, after this law was enacted, two men were the first to be arrested and eventually charged with a felony for digging up flytraps in the wild. They had 1,025 flytraps on them. Their bond was set at $1 million. That is an amount usually reserved for murder suspects. That's the level we're at here. More recently, in March 2019, a poacher was charged with 216 felony counts, one for each Venus flytrap he took from the Green Swamp Preserve. That does sound a little harsh, but we don't want any plant species to disappear and become extinct. Because what if it's a cure for cancer? Have you ever seen the movie Rain Man? Makes me think of that. And even if it's not a cure for cancer, we will still lose an important part of American biodiversity. Then the only way to see the Venus flytrap native to the American South would be to buy a clone from a lab, either in China or the Netherlands. Well, I guess we do have one here now in the U.S., so I guess we could buy it from there. But the point is, they won't exist in the wild anymore, and that's mind-boggling. Some people do think the next step to preserve the Venus flytrap would be to add it to the endangered species list, and that is heavily advised against because all that would do is increase the black market value and increase demand because now poachers would get paid even more. And we definitely don't want that to happen. It does seem like since the state of North Carolina upgraded the misdemeanor to a Class H felony, the poachers have slowed down. They're still there, but it does seem like they have slowed down. It seems to be working, and I definitely hope for the best that this does get back under control. One of the things they're doing to help bring back and ensure Venus flytraps, because once they get dug up, then they're not there. So to keep the natural habitat, like I said, they're only growing in North Carolina in the wild. So it's a very specific habitat to grow Venus flytraps. It's incredibly hard to grow them anywhere else. They're very finicky. And one of the things that rangers, officers are doing is controlled burns. Anytime there is a burn and a lot of that thick brush is cleared out, many Venus flytraps will pop back up in that area. Because once you get that super thick brush, it makes it harder and harder for the Venus flytraps to grow because now they're blocked from the sun with all of that brush. Controlled burns are one action, one step that does help bring them back each year. And the officers do take great pride in helping to preserve the biodiversity and continuing to save and salvage the Venus flytrap. This story was a bit crazy, a bit wild, a bit off the wall, but absolutely fascinating to me when I first heard about it. And I thought, I have never heard of this. And I have to share it. And I hope that you enjoy learning about this as well. And tomorrow when you go into work and you have to make some small talk at the water cooler with your coworkers, now you have a really cool, fascinating story to kick off the conversation. It is time for the challenge. It is very beautiful fall weather outside. The 90s are gone. It is now a high of 70s in the day, which is amazing hiking weather. And I want to know if you have gone hiking yet. We have not. We had plans to go hiking when we were in Pennsylvania. But as I already said, because it was in the 90s and there was a prisoner on the loose, we didn't. We are making plans to go hiking this weekend, and I hope that you do so as well. And while you're out hiking, take a look at the plants along the trail. Can you name any of them? Can you legally forage any of them? I'd be curious. Please. I am curious about your adventures, and I would like for you to share them on the Facebook group, Starting Sustainability. The next episode will be October 9th, and that will be episode 150 and a special kickoff celebration to Halloween / spooky type related sustainable stories that I found a long time ago and I've been holding on to them. And I am so excited to share them with you. In the next episode, we will cover how littering can lead to grizzly bear attacks. So tune in and check it out. Until then, continue saving the world, Sustainer Nation, and I will talk to you all again on October 9th. Have a great one. Bye.